More wicked weather hitting the Northeast. Meanwhile, here in the Midwest, we wonder, what does Old Man Winter still have in store for us? It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the program, we'll ask how this harsh winter will go down in weather history. We'll find out why the Iowa Senate passed emergency heating aid this week. Clay Masters will tell us about the debate over regulating e-cigarettes. We'll examine a new long-term study that questions the benefits of mammography screening. And the band Lake Street Dive makes their TV debut on the Colbert Report. We'll talk with band member and Iowa native Bridget Carney. A News Buzz edition of River to River after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A News Buzz edition on this Friday on our program. A little later in the program, we'll talk about how this harsh winter will go down in weather history. Also, we'll meet Bridget Carney. She's an Iowan whose band, Lake Street Dive, made their TV debut a few days ago. Perhaps you caught them. They were on the Colbert Report. But first, this week, the Iowa House began debate of a bill to regulate so-called e-cigarettes. Joining us now to tell us about that debate and its twists and turns is Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters. Hi, Clay.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us about the issue here. What are lawmakers wrestling with in regards to e-cigarettes?
Well, the House arguably is done with their wrestling. This week, the Iowa House voted to ban the sale of e-cigarettes that contain nicotine to minors. You know, I'd never seen an e-cigarette. You know, I'd seen one from afar, but I'd never really looked at one. So I went to an e-cigarette shop in Des Moines and spoke with the manager there. And it was interesting. You know, they have a like a buffet of options of different flavors for your e-cigarette, different strengths of nicotine. So you could, if you're into a more harsher flavor when you pull the drag off that cigarette, you can control that down to no nicotine at all.
Mm-hmm. So if you take the nicotine out, as this bill does, then what you're left with is what, flavor variants?
Yeah, different flavors. So some of them, and we'll get into this argument in a minute, I think, some of them are flavored to like cherry or grape. The e-cigarette store I went to, you know, they're branded with marketing strategies that some argue are targeted for younger audiences. I saw one this week that was called Space Jam, which was a 1990s Bugs Bunny Michael Jordan movie. So, no, but the argument there is that, you know, there are brands of e-cigarettes that are being targeted to minors, and there are lawmakers that said that this bill didn't go far enough because it only banned those e-cigarettes that contain nicotine.
So tell us a little bit more about who sponsored this bill and what it would do exactly.
Well, Chip Baltimore, a Republican representative from Boone, talked on the floor most of the time, and he said the bill keeps those e-cigarettes with nicotine out of the hands of children. The e-cigarette store that I went to, the manager there, Alicia Kirby, told me that she and her organization, her company, has been IDing people for as long as it's been around. So they don't sell any of their products, according to her, to any minors, whether or not it has nicotine or not.
I understand Cedar Rapids Democrat Representative Tyler Olson offered an amendment to that bill. What did he want to change?
Well, and that's what he wanted to change is largely what we've been talking about. He wanted to ban all e-cigarettes, whether or not they have nicotine or not, because his concern was that it's a gateway for kids to get into smoking the real thing.
But there also is the socialization, the normalization of a teenager, 14, 15-year-old, going to the store, buying an e-cigarette that maybe doesn't have nicotine, and smoking that e-cigarette with their friends. And the habits that that forms then, as they might reach the age of 18 and able to purchase traditional cigarettes. So I think it's not just the nicotine that causes that habit forming. And I want to make sure that all e-cigarettes, whether they have nicotine or don't, are kept out of the hands of minors.
And here's Boone Republican Representative Chip Baltimore. He rose on the floor to respond to these concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, ladies and gentlemen of the House. With regards to Representative Olson's first point, that this bill does not regulate non-nicotine vapor products. You know, I guess once you remove the cancer-causing smoke from the equation, and once you remove the addictive nicotine from the equation, what you're really regulating is a plastic tube with humidity.
Okay, Chip Baltimore there, Boone Republican. So what happened to Representative Olson's amendment?
Well, Republicans who control the Iowa House effectively blocked debate from happening on his amendment, ruling that it was not germane. I asked Speaker of the House Craig Paulson yesterday why they voted that it was not germane. He said that it expanded the scope of the bill and it changed the title, so that, in fact, makes it not germane. Now, we did also ask if he thinks minors should be buying e-cigarettes without nicotine. That mm-hmm. is Craig Paulson. And he said no.
So Clay, as we wrap up this conversation, what is the status of the bill right now?
Well, the bill now moves to the Senate, where Senator Bill Dotsler, I spoke with him, he's a Democrat from Waterloo. He serves on a subcommittee for a companion bill in the Senate. He said his caucus has not discussed the legislation, but members of his caucus have similar concerns to Olson. Now, Dotsler says his goal is to pass a bill that will stop Iowa children from legally obtaining and using e-cigarettes and receive the support of the House and a signature from the governor.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any predictions, any sense of how the regulation of e-cigarettes in Iowa will shake out?
Well, it's hard to tell, but because the House has already voted on theirs and there's an urgency to get things done early on in the session, this might be the opportunity that they go with.
Clay Masters, thank you. Iowa Public Radio's Morning Edition host and reporter at the State House.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of our program on this Friday. The Iowa Senate voted 41-8 on Tuesday to provide an extra $2 million in state money to help needy Iowans pay for rising heating costs associated with this frigid winter we've been having. Senator Liz Mathis, a Democrat of Cedar Rapids, is the floor manager for this Senate file, 2110. She joins us by phone. Senator Mathis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate having this opportunity to talk about something that's so necessary.
Explain in detail a little bit why this measure is needed.
Well, I chair Admin and Reg, and it oversees human rights, which oversees our community action programs, which, distributes LIHEAP funding.
Low-income home energy assistance program, LIHEAP, yes.
And so we had heard testimony earlier in the month from human rights that home energy was necessary. They were running out of a few funds. They weren't really very specific about how much money they needed, because in early January, we knew that there was a crisis, but we didn't really know how much. Well, as January proceeded, funds were being used more and more, and into February, even more. So we felt it necessary, at least the Democrats in Admin and Reg, to try to push the issue. And so we did try to bring something into Admin and Reg through a procedural issue, and it didn't work so well. Mm. And so we decided that we would do a supplemental bill in the Senate and then send it over to the House.
What scenarios have you heard about that cause real concern here that launched this extra $2 million?
Well, we've heard anecdotal information that people are people who don't normally ask for LIHEAP funding are coming into, in my instance, it's in Hiawatha, is the Hawkeye Area Community Action Program, HACAP. And so more people are asking for assistance, which increases the amount of money that's being used, but also because of people who are hooked up to propane. And propane is a completely different issue, but we're seeing, skyrocketing costs in propane, and then that throws your monthly bill off. But we're also seeing increases in furnaces breaking down and people turning their furnaces down to 50 because they, you know, have budgeted for a certain amount, but they're using much more. And so that causes concern. I did have one family who called me. They had asked for some propane fuel. They'd paid. It took about a week and a half for the guy to get to their house. In the meantime, they took the kids to a hotel. They said it was cheaper for them to be in a hotel at a nightly rate than it was to try to keep their home heat going, and they didn't have much in their propane tank left, so they didn't really want to risk that, so they moved into a hotel for about a week, which, you know, is costly and it's unnecessary when we should be helping a family like that.
Mm-hmm. Where will this extra $2 million, should it pass the House, where will this $2 million come from?
Well, it will come from the general fund. The Republicans did have an amendment that they wanted some of the money to come from an innovation fund that's through economic growth or economic development. So we, you know, voted that amendment down.
Mm-hmm. So it sailed through the Senate, 41-8, the vote on Tuesday.
Yes.
What chances does it have in the House, you think? The Republicans are in control of the House here in Iowa.
Well, I am hoping that they will hear the needs of their constituents and they will take a look at the hard facts. So a lot of the GOP in the House had said to me, well, listen, you know, we want to wait and see approach. We want to, you know, kind of wait a little bit because maybe this isn't the right number. Well, I believe it is the right number because what we asked the community action programs to do is send us some data before I went onto the floor to kind of give us a better snapshot, you know, really hard data. And that data shows that they are already using, and this was shocking to me, they're already using money that they had in reserve to buy propane for next year at a contract price. So, you know, you can lock in your price at $1.70 or $2, whatever it is. So they portion off a certain amount of money to do that, not all the money, because, you know, you certainly don't want to buy it at a higher price. And I think legislators would frown on that as well. So they were already using some of that money in reserve to pay for energy needs right now. And that's not good. That's not a good way to balance the budget or to try to fulfill the needs of, you know, the energy that Iowans need. So that was one of the things. The other part that we saw is that the Department of Human Rights released some money that they would normally reserve for maybe April or May, and already within the first 2 days, 21% of it was used.
Mm-hmm.
So the rapidity of the use of emergency funds being released and the expenditures that were going to, you know, supposed to go for LP gas and the purchases on contract were already used were two indications that I thought we need to move and we need to move now. We've got 75 or fewer than 75 days left to pay some of these bills coming in, and people are just now getting their January bills.
Right, and it would be one thing if we were saying this was the middle of March, but we're the middle of February. We could have quite a few weeks of hard winter coming at us.
Yes, we could, and we've seen that in the past. And, you know, and it's not just us. It's a lot of other states are feeling the crunch, too. I mean, you know, you've seen in the South where the ice storms, you know, have really hit and hit hard, and they're asking for some emergency relief. And I'm sure they'll be asking for some of the same things we are. But that's, you know, the federal government gives LIHEAP a certain amount, and they budget a certain amount. Actually, the amount this year is well beneath the amounts that they've apportioned for years past. But they give them an amount based on a regular winter, you know, that with normal temperatures. This was something that was beyond anyone's control, and there are several times where the state is asked to step up and help their own when there is federal funding involved. This is one of many instances, I think, that we've seen in the past, you know, that that we need to help our own in the state of Iowa.
Senator Liz Mathis of Cedar Rapids, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Ben. Thanks. It was a pleasure.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River on this snowy Friday. I'm Ben Kiefer. The debate over annual mammogram screenings was in the news again this week. This as follow-up data from a long-term study came under fire. Researchers with the Canadian National Breast Screening Study conducted a 25-year, follow-up with their participants, they concluded that, quote, annual mammography in women aged 40 to 59 does not reduce mortality from breast cancer beyond that of physical examination or usual care when adjuvant therapy for breast cancer is freely available. Adjuvant care given after surgery, such as chemotherapy, radiation, or hormone treatments. These results were published Wednesday in the British Medical Journal, but several professional associations and experts have questioned the study. The authors' conclusions of this study. Joining us now to talk about the latest study, Dr. Laura Fajardo, a breast imaging expert and professor of radiology at the University of Iowa. Professor Dr. Fajardo, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I quoted a little bit of the findings. Can you sort of interpret that for us? Explain the findings of this study a little bit more.
Okay. So this study, and I would preface it by saying of all the screening studies that have been done over the last three decades that have undergone these comprehensive systematic reviews, of which there are probably, you know, a good 10 to 12, this is the only study that has not reached conclusions that mammography is of benefit. So we need a preface with that. And it's been controversial since it was conducted and initiated 25 years ago. But this was their 25-year follow-up of the patients that had participated in the Canadian trial. It was only located in one specific region of Canada, not others. And what it found was that patients who had mammography versus those who did not really didn't seem to fare any better. So the number of breast cancers that were found in each of the two groups was roughly similar, and the number of patients dying from breast cancer was also similar. But as we all know, you know, that this trial was sort of doomed from the beginning because the way that they set it up was a little bit different than other randomized controlled screening trials. Mm-hmm. So all of the women coming into this trial first had a breast clinical examination, and then they were randomized to have a mammogram or not have a mammogram. And what really should have happened was they would first be randomized. And what this meant was that people knew what the patient's clinical examinations showed before they even were randomized to screening. Mm-hmm. And the way we conduct mammography now is that screening patients are patients who have completely normal mammograms, normal physical examination, but they have a normal physical exam and they don't have symptoms. And we apply screening mammography in this population to find things that aren't found on clinical exam.
When listening to you to describe this latest study, it sounds to me like you're saying the takeaway from this study should not shift the practice of annual mammographies for women of certain age.
I think that's true. As I said, this is only one of many studies. And, you know, being performed 25 years ago, you know, it was done with mammography systems that we really don't use anymore. They were all film-based. And, in fact, there were a lot of issues with the quality of these trials. They had at least three American experts involved in the trial, two of whom resigned from the trial because the people conducting it were not following quality standards that we incorporate in the United States regarding the quality of the mammogram, the training of the technologists, and the training of the radiologists who interpret those. And other experts that they had go back and review films had the same conclusions, that they really weren't of very high quality. So that sort of cast doubt in the study to begin with.
Nevertheless, we've got a couple minutes left. I just want to say, nevertheless, there are pros and cons of annual mammograms, aren't there not?
There certainly are. And, you know, it's changed. You know, we now, for the last 10 years, have been using digital mammography. And there's an even new and better technology right now called digital breast tomosynthesis that's like a mammogram, except it's a 3D mammogram. And we have found that that examination has considerably fewer false positives, which is the recall rate, the number of women called back after a screening mammogram to have extra pictures, the majority of which turn out to be nothing. Well, that recall rate has been considerably reduced with the event of these 3D mammograms. We have embraced this extensively in our practice and found it to be one of the most useful new technologies that has come onto the breast screening arena.
Remind us, how likely is a woman in this country to get breast cancer?
Well, if you live to be, 95 years old, the chance is about 1 in 10. Of course, by decade of age, it's not that high. So the chance of a woman in their 30s to 40s might be only 1 in 200. So we have to put all of that into perspective. Women, I think, get barraged with a lot of information that's sort of, the extreme of how bad breast cancer is, and now they're being barraged with information about the density of their breast tissue on a mammogram. And I think we have to do a better job of educating everybody and putting these various risk factors into context.
The self-examination, still first and foremost, a very important step to take to prevent breast cancer.
I think it certainly is. Women who practice regular self-breast examination really know their breasts better than anybody. They may see their doctor only once a year for the doctor's examination, but, when a woman comes to me and says, I examine my breasts regularly and I have this new place here, I really do take that very seriously. And some women are not comfortable examining their own breasts, but, I would recommend that, women really think about that. It's kind of up there with, trying to have regular exercise and good diet and all the other healthy lifestyle behaviors that we try to follow.
Breast imaging expert and professor of radiology at the University of Iowa, Dr. Laura Fajardo, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up in just a moment, more wicked weather hits the Northeast. Meanwhile, here in the Midwest, we're wondering, what does Old Man Winter still have in store for us? Also, the band Lake Street Dive makes their TV debut, perhaps you caught it a few days ago, on the Colbert Report. We'll talk with a band member, and one of the band members happening to be an Iowa native, Bridget Carney, that coming up in the second half hour. And Lake Darling in southeast Iowa reaches a milestone this week. Hey, it's Valentine's Day. Why shouldn't there be something in it for Lake Darling? And that's coming up in the second half hour.
Love is in the air, everywhere I look around.
Well, it's Valentine's Day. Love and perhaps some snow may be in the air where you are. And in honor of that fact, for our news buzz today, we're having Love by the Numbers, courtesy of the U.S. Census Bureau. As you may have heard earlier today on Talk of Iowa, Americans spend a lot of money on chocolate just on this day. But did you know there were 1,148 manufacturing establishments in the U.S. in 2011 making chocolate or cocoa products and employing more than 35,000 people? If you still need a gift for your sweetheart, you might try the one of 23,394 jewelry stores in the U.S. If you're hoping for marriage, the odds are in your favor. Almost 53% of Americans reported being married last year, and nearly 69% reported being married at some point in their lives. 6% of women who said they were married in 2009 had been married for more at least 50 years. And if you're still looking, you always employ one of the 393 dating services reported in 2007. Those services, including internet dating sites, reported $928 million in revenue. We'll be right back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Love is in the air.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The band, with a native Iowan member, Lake Street Dive, made their TV debut on the Colbert Report a few days ago. We'll talk with that band member, Iowa native Bridget Carney, coming up in just a few minutes. Lake Darling in southeast Iowa marked a major milestone this week. That after a 12-year, $16 million renovation. Joining us to tell us about it, Chad Dolan, Fisheries Management Biologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Chad, hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing fine. So, something big happened at Lake Darling on Wednesday. What was it?
It was the second formal gate setting of the dam. It was a culmination of a large-scale restoration project. February 12th also marked the anniversary of Ding Darling's death. And, of course, Lake Darling was named after Ding. So it was kind of a monumentous moment.
So this gate setting, the last time that was done was back when Ding Darling was there, the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist was there. That gate comes down. It's been a long, dry lake bed up until this point. The gate comes down, and what? Now it starts to fill.
Now it starts to fill, and honestly, you know, it's not going to fill overnight. It's going to take a little bit of time, but Lake Darling has a fairly substantial watershed. You know, before the lake renovation work, we're talking a 47-to-1 watershed to lake area ratio. That means that the lake should fill fairly quickly. You know, our best projections are once the spring thaw hits, it's going to take about a month. In reality, you know, it could happen a little bit quicker than that. So we might be being a little conservative, but the point is it's not going to take very long.
This is a lake now over 300 acres in size. Is that comparable to the size it was before this renovation?
That's correct, yes. Due to heavy sedimentation and nutrient input over 60 years' time, it had been reduced to about 267 acres. And, you know, through this renovation, through removing, sediment and also building a new drain structure, a baffle riser, drain tube structure, and raising essentially the lake elevation 2 feet, we'll be back to 304 acres.
Mm-hmm. So we had 60 years of silt and nutrients washed from this basin that you talked about, the watershed into here. Give us an idea of how much silt was removed over the last 12 years.
Yes, it was a crazy amount, but it totaled 309,000 cubic yards. You know, that number probably doesn't mean a lot to people, but if you put that in perspective, that would fill an entire football field 144 feet deep, or in other words, to the height of a 12-story building.
A football field 12 stories high full of silt that had been washed there over decades. So you think after our spring thaw, it'll take about a month to fill it up. Will it be good for recreation right away in the summer months or not?
Yeah, you know, we're kind of projecting that, you know, the park will reopen again about July 1st. You know, although the in-lake work is done, there's still some work to be done within the park, such as, you know, fixing park roads. They're all being replaced, et cetera. But, you know, what people are going to see first is a lake full of water. And, of course, just having the aesthetics of that back will be fantastic. Fish stocking is slated to happen in early summer, and of course, then it'll be about 2 to 3 years before those fish reach maturity and they're able to be caught, you know. But before that happens, just the joy of being around, you know, a beautiful lake again, and a much clearer and cleaner lake for that matter, mm-hmm. is going to be great for most people.
So with this renovation, the problem is fixed for good?
Well, you know, sedimentation will always occur, but, you know, with this project, you know, it started in the watershed and working with local landowners and concerned citizens, stewards of the land. So a lot of watershed features have been installed, you know, on the landscape, such as sediment retention ponds that will slow the transport of water to the lake. Conservation reserve program lands have been put into place. Prairies within the park, tile outlet terraces, the list goes on and on. But all those are aimed at filtering water or impeding the movement of water and catching that sediment and those adhered nutrients and essentially allowing only clean water to make itself, you know, make its way to the lake basin and ultimately result in a cleaner Lake Darling.
Okay, if I head to Lake Darling later in this year after the fish have been stocked, do they grow up a bit? What type of fish am I possibly going to catch?
Bluegill, largemouth bass, channel catfish, and red ear sunfish, and crappies, black crappies.
Okay, Chad Dolan, fisheries management biologist for the Iowa DNR. Thanks for the update, Chad.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition on this snowy Friday. Snowy over most parts of the state overnight and this morning. I wish I could say we're almost through this tough winter, but then I remind myself that it's only mid-February. And light snow across many parts of the state this morning. Another reminder, additional snow forecast for tomorrow, Saturday. I think the highest accumulations expected in the northern part of the state, up to 2 inches, if I'm not mistaken. Joining me now to talk about the winter that was so far and the winter that may still be ahead of us, Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology in the Department of Earth Science at the University of Northern Iowa, in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Ben. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you back with us. So tell us, the hallmark of this winter so far has to be that those deathly cold temperatures in January. How cold did we get?
Oh, yeah. And the fact that it just doesn't relent at all. It just keeps going and going. Well, we started out in December with cold temperatures across the state. So that kind of set us up for our cold January. The December ranking for temperatures in Iowa, it put us as the 14th coldest December in the climate record back to 1895. Our state climatologist has some records that go back farther than that. But the national data that we that I'm looking at with you today is a 120-year record. So December was the 14th coldest. January, it turns out, was the 27th coldest January.
It sure felt colder than that, Alan.
It did, didn't it? That's right. I think the fact is that it just did not let up.
Yeah.
The western part of the state got a little bit of a reprieve very, very briefly. They did see some mid-60s. On January 19th, but that didn't last very long even there.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps was it our feeling that it was colder than the historical record sort of bears out? It was not the coldest in over 100 years. But is it because that we just have had very mild winters recently and we kind of got used to it, got thin skins?
I think that is a bit of it. Since I think 1990, we have had some of the warmer Januaries in our climate record, but we don't have to go too far back, and we have some of, if not the coldest, in the 1970s, and it's reaching a little bit far back for our recollection, but we don't have to go, 100 years back or anything to get significantly colder.
I remember the 70s being a boy, Alan, and actually temperatures that we've had this year, and actually going outside my door and right there in Cedar Falls where I grew up and trying to spit and see if it would freeze before it hit the ground.
Did you have success?
I think I did. There's some imagination involved, but I think it did happen, yes.
Yes.
Tell us, speaking of other precipitation, how does snowfall compare in the historical record this year?
Well, we've actually been on the dry side. December, again, it's kind of starting out with the winter months of December, January, and February. December was dry across the state. It was the 28th driest January. I'm sorry, 28th driest December. And January was likewise dry. We were the 20th driest January in our state record.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit, have you comment about what's happening in the southeast and now in the northeast part of the country. What contributed to this unusual pattern of events that's led to ice in Atlanta, snow in the Atlanta as well?
That the storm track that we've seen with those low-pressure systems really isn't that unusual. Typically December, January, February, there's a pretty good storm track that comes from the Gulf of Mexico across Florida and along the East Coast there. And it really, those storms thrive on the temperature contrast between the colder continental air and the warmer Atlantic air, and that just provides a lot of energy. That's not really that unusual, but I think the fact that we have had so much cold air in place over the eastern U.S., as those storm systems pull that moisture off the Atlantic up over that colder air, it's just perfect conditions for the production of a lot of ice at the surface and transitioning over to snow. So it's they've just been hit pretty hard by that, both the effect of sort of typical winter storm tracks, but just that extra cold air that's in place.
Well, let's look toward the rest of the winter. If I can say we're approximately two-thirds away through our winter, what about the remaining third based on what we've experienced, Alan? What can you say?
Well, we have certainly been colder than normal so far this month, but there's reason to be hopeful. The outlook that takes us about through the end of the month doesn't project anything like 70 degrees, but it does look like it's going to be milder next week in particular. temperatures by Friday of next week probably be about 10 degrees above normal across the state. So that's going to feel pretty good.
No more deep freeze?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. There's still plenty of winter. In fact, early March of 1963, I think it was, we actually set some record lows in the area, Waterloo in particular. So it can get pretty cold yet.
Okay, and as far as this weekend, I mentioned a forecast, some snow for a lot of the state in the tomorrow, as a matter of fact, huh?
Yeah, Saturday, probably mostly during the daytime, probably over by Sunday morning. But then again, Sunday night into Monday looks like it might be a little bit more significant precip event. So kind of watch our conditions, I guess, for Monday.
Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology in the Department of Earth Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks for stepping into our studio, Alan.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally, on this Valentine's Day, we get to bathe in the glow of a fellow Iowan hitting the big time. The name of this tune is called Rabbit Animal. It was written by Iowa native Bridget Carney. Here, Bridget is playing acoustic bass along with her band Lake Street Dive. Rachel Price with the lead vocals just a few days ago on the Colbert Report. Bridget Carney joins me from Washington, D.C. She actually lives in New York. Bridget Carney, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, congratulations on this big coup being on the Colbert Report.
Thank you. Thank you. We were as surprised as everyone else.
Uh-huh. Stephen Colbert's show watched by, I think, a couple million viewers. Some of the most watched late-night television there is around on cable television, Comedy Central. How in the world did your band land this gig?
Well, Stephen Colbert had heard of our band through a friend of his, and so the request came in to us actually like straight from the top, I guess, not really through their like music coordinator, which is how I'm led to believe it usually happens. So yeah, he was just like into the music and, you know, wanted to have us on the show, which we're, you know, extremely honored about, especially considering our sort of like low status on the totem pole, right? You know, at this point, like, it was really special to have him reach out to us and want to have us on the show.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that jumped out at me, too. Is Stephen Colbert, first of all, only occasionally has musical guests on the show, and they are, if we can say, you know, of a much higher profile than you currently are. So that is a surprise.
Yeah, that's like one thing that's really cool about, you know, what's happening for us right now is we're getting asked to do these things that are much larger than our scale, and you know, whenever anything happens like that, you have to feel like it's really genuine and that like they really want you because of your music, because, you know, there's no reason other than that they would want you, you know.
Yeah.
There's nobody owes us any favors, and there's not this like surging public demand for us to be everywhere. So if anytime anyone asks us to do it, something, it's, you know, for musical reasons, and that's really special.
Mm-hmm. In the past few months, you've received accolades from other areas. The New Yorker raving about you. Rolling Stone calls you unexpected showstoppers. Let's listen to some of the interview that your band Lake Street Dive did with Stephen Colbert just a few days ago on February 5th.
Okay, you are Lake Street Dive. You guys exploded this year with a YouTube video. Everybody watched. You did a great cover of I Want You Back by the Jackson 5. First television appearance tonight.
Very yes. First.
Are you ready for the... Are you guys ready for the bump?
Yes.
You ready for the Colbert bump?
Yeah.
All right, let's do these things. Where did you meet?
In college, at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston.
Okay, what is a conservatory? Because is that the place where Colonel Mustard kills you with a candlestick? What is that?
It's a place where, well, a conservatory of music is where you study music, and you don't generally study other subjects. You study just music.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
It's very focused.
Okay, so is this classical musical training?
We study jazz.
Jazz. Oh, then why do I like your music?
Lake Street Dive being interviewed on Stephen Colbert just a few days ago. Bridget Carney is with us, a member of Lake Street Dive. It's been just over a week since that broadcast. Of course, that broadcast, clips from it live on over the internet, over the website at Colbert Nation. Also, we'll put some clips on our website. What has this bump been like?
Well, it's been pretty immediate and pretty tangible. You know, we've played a few shows since then, and there's just like lines out the door and people shouting good job on Colbert, you know, just like really sort of obvious signs of this Colbert bump, which is a real phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And actually my brother, Matt Carney, told me that one of his econ professors invented this term, which is a small world.
Oh, he invented the term a bump, a Colbert bump, or the term bump for this kind of exposure?
Colbert bump, yeah. He invented the Colbert bump. He was the, like, political analyst and the guy who looked at all the numbers and was like, wow, this guy's show is having a real effect on real-world things, you know, be it, like, I mean, I guess a band's shows are kind of the smallest level of the Colbert bump, you know, leading all the way up to, you know, the presidential campaign and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So help us understand, because we're not musicians, most of us anyway, what does that mean? What is the next level this is taking you to?
I mean, I guess we're about to find out, but in some ways it's the next level is like really different for your life. And in a lot of ways it's the same, because you're still like, you know, I've been playing with this band for almost 10 years now, and the four of us run around together and write music together and play music together, and that stuff is all going to be the same, which is great. I'm glad that we've had these, like, 10 years together to sort of get that, you know, fine-tuned before we're kind of, like, thrust into, like, the maelstrom, you know, of, mm-hmm. I don't know, just, I mean, even from the last couple of days, like, the shows have gotten a lot crazier.
March 25th, you're still booked for the Englert in downtown Iowa City. Folks here in Iowa can come out to see you. You've played numerous times in Iowa City. Let's play a little more of the interview, a very quick clip of you answering a question on the Colbert Report February 5th, a few days ago. This is where Stephen Colbert asks you a question, Bridget Carney.
This the album is called Bad Self-Portraits, and what does that name mean? Is this a mashup of Bob Dylan's Self-Portrait and Michael Jackson's Bad? What does that mean, Bad Self-Portrait? Because you're all very attractive. You're all very attractive young people. Why would you have a bad self-portrait?
Well, I think bad self-portraits are like something that you see around a lot right now. It's kind of like the stupidest zeitgeist.
Like Instagram, people selfies of themselves and sending them around to everybody.
Yeah, they're everywhere and they're awful. So
right. All right, you've alienated a fair amount of my audience right now. But that's brave. That's very courageous of you.
Bridget Carney being interviewed by Stephen Colbert a few days ago. How were you prepared for Colbert? You arrive, you meet him beforehand, Bridget?
We did, yeah. We met him in the dressing room.
In or out of character?
Out of character. He greets all his guests before the show out of character and sort of just gives you a heads up to what it's going to be like, just in case you've never seen the show, I guess.
Well, what did he say specifically to your band members?
Well, he says that he's going to be doing the show in character, and he says that his character is willfully ignorant of what you do and, you know, things in the world in general. So, I don't know. I guess that's like the introduction that you get and how to sort of take what he's saying to you, you know, all the stuff that he said about, like, why do I like your band if you like jazz and what is conservatory, you know, he's willfully ignorant, and that's the way that he does the show.
Let's go out, Bridget Carney, with another original song that was performed on the Colbert Report, also a great Valentine's Day tune. You go down smooth. Here you're playing the upright bass, the acoustic bass.
Mm-hmm.
We hope it's smooth sailing and a rise to the top. It sure looks like it. Bridget Carney, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
And you can look for links to those performances on the Colbert show. Bridget Carney, Iowa native, Lake Street Dive, performing on the Colbert show. Look for links on our website or our Facebook page. They're performing at the England Theater in Iowa City on March 25th. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks to our producers, Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.